Every once in a while, I'll arrive at a meeting late. Because I didn't look at my calendar. I didn't need to, you see. Because I knew. I mean, I absolutely knew the meeting started at 1:30. When it actually started at 1. I tell myself it's just a little lapse of memory. I suspect that would never happen to Eric Kandel. The Nobel Prize winner has spent a lifetime studying the science of memory. In a fascinating new book called In Search of Memory, The Emergence of a New Science of the Mind, he writes about where memory lives. One famous case involves a patient who had surgery to stop debilitating epileptic fits.
He was left with the most dramatic memory deficit you could possibly imagine. He cannot take new short-term information and put it into new long-term information. HN can remember things that happened to him prior to the operation. He can remember his childhood traumata. He can remember going to elementary school and high school. Everything that happened before the operation is fine. He has a good short-term memory. So if you introduce him to Jim Fleming, he will be able to repeat Jim Fleming's name. Introduce him to Eric Kandel, he'll repeat Eric Kandel. Comes back to Jim Fleming, he's forgotten it completely. So his difficulty is taking new information, like Jim Fleming, and putting this into long-term memory. So when he sits down to eat a meal, as soon as he's finished it, he thinks he hasn't had a meal. Starts all over again. He starts reading a newspaper. By the time he's finished the first column, he's forgotten it. He starts all over again. Just a remarkable deficit.
But at the same time, if I understood this correctly, there were some skills that he was able to pick up without remembering them. Physical skills he could learn. He didn't remember that he'd learned them, but he still had them.
There were certain skills he could learn and he could remember. These were perceptual and motor skills, but he, in fact, on an unconscious level, acquired all these skills. And many of the things we do, much of mental life, as Freud first pointed out, is unconscious. You and I are talking to one another. We're having a perfectly civilized conversation. I understand everything you ask of me, and I hope that you understand my responses. But you and I are not paying any attention consciously to the grammar of our speech. So we use grammar unconsciously.
In fact, these things are happening in different parts of the brain, and the transfer is taking place in different parts of the brain.
Absolutely. There are two major memory systems in the brain, a conscious memory system and an unconscious memory system. And they have different names. The most convenient is explicit for conscious and implicit for unconscious. They involve different brain regions. So the explicit memory, which is a memory for people, places and objects, and if I think about a person like my wife Denise, I have to make a conscious effort to recall her face. On the other hand, when it comes to grammar, this is implicit, this is completely unconscious. And different regions of the brain, hippocampus for consciously oriented memories, and the amygdala, the striatum, the cerebellum. In the simplest cases, the reflex pathways themselves mediate this implicit unconscious memory. Much of my work, certainly everyone's work in simple invertebrate animals, is on implicit memory storage.
What does this mean when it comes to an exploration of other kinds of memory? I know you have done a fair amount of research on the question of aging and memory, which is very much in the popular mind right now. Are these related?
Yes. So in addition to thinking of explicit and implicit memory storage, it's useful to think of memory as having two other components. One is the storage mechanism. How is memory stored at any given site in the brain? And the other is the systems problem. What are the different sites that are involved in memory storage? Hippocampus versus amygdala, for example, or hippocampus versus striatum. It turns out that the storage mechanism, the mechanisms that are used at each one of these sites, has, as we would predict from our early discussions, conserved elements. The same molecules are used for implicit and explicit memory storage, even though the neural circuitry is different. So we began to explore age-related memory loss by looking at complex memories, memory for people, places, and objects, and we did this in a mouse. The mouse ages, and when mice age, a significant percentage of them show a weakening of memory with age. We could look at the storage mechanism, and we could see what went wrong. And it was a little bit like a nutritional deficiency, like diabetes. We could give the equivalent of insulin and make the memory better. So if you're a mouse, we can treat your age-related memory deficits perfectly well. In people, we're not sure as yet.
In your research, did you find that this notion of conserved process applies universally, or did you find that there are differences? I was thinking again about HM, the patient who could learn physical skills without remembering that he had. Is there any difference in the way that memory is acquired in these two different areas, and does that show up in your study of age-related memory loss?
Yes. So implicit memory storage often doesn't require a high level of attention while you acquire it, while explicit memory storage for people, places, and objects requires a lot of attention. So the nature of the salience of the event is much more important in one kind of memory than other. So there are different rules that guide the two sets of memory processes. So there is conservation on some level, but there are also differences in others. But one of the interesting things about evolution and mental processes is the notion of combinatorial. You can take a few building blocks, if you will, and elaborate on them to make a much richer set of processes. And what explicit memory does is to use more neural circuits to combine them in different ways. So even though the elementary components are very similar, the outcome is much richer in the case where you add these various components than it is in the most elementary case.
Is it a value to have that richer storage of memory when it comes to the loss of memory due to aging, or is it in fact a problem?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons elaborate memories tend to disappear is because they are elaborate. So if you break down at any given point, it degenerates the memory a little bit. So it is wonderful when memory is functioning well because it gives us the nuanced, sophisticated ability to recall smells and sounds and contexts and feeling states. On the other hand, when you have something elaborate, it's more susceptible to breaking down.
This is why when I can't remember a word that I know perfectly well, it may be the intervening processes that are getting in the way, even though that word is stored somewhere.
Absolutely. Other distracting thoughts may interfere with that. You're absolutely right.
Do you feel as though the biology of memory is going to be the determining factor? Is it purely a biological function?
100%. This doesn't make it any less romantic, any less wonderful. Look, you and I know that my heart and your heart are a muscular pump that drives blood through the circulation. But that doesn't make it any less interesting, fascinating, important. I was watching Charlie Rose when he first came back after his operation on his mitral valve. And he described in detail how this great surgeon in Paris was operating on his mitral valve. That's all biology, that's all surgery, that's all medicine, but it doesn't make it any less magnificent, interesting, and wonderful to behold the repair of a complex organ by biological surgical means.
The fact that we store memories in a neurological, biological fashion doesn't make the memory more or less interesting. What we do with it is still what matters.
Exactly, exactly. This often bothers certain people because it thinks it the idea of biology of all mental processes violates some religious stricture. And I think most scientists don't believe that at all. They believe that there is a separation, a sphere in which science has its say and a sphere in which religion has its say. And the two are independent. And that the mind is a set of biological processes carried out in the brain has no bearing on your religious belief or lack thereof.
Do you think, though, that there is any value to making the study of the mind and spirituality such a physical, biological process? Is there any way in which it denigrates religion to do that, spirituality to do that?
Not in the slightest. If you and I were to go to a museum with a curator of a museum, and they explain the motivation of Matisse in painting a particular scene or a particular woman, and we see exactly how he layers on the paint, how he develops a perspective, even though the image is fairly flat, we get a deeper understanding of it that enhances our appreciation, enhances our enjoyment. In no way, knowing more about something, in no way detracts from our instinctive aesthetic response to a work of art. The brain is the same way. I find that in every area in which I move, the deeper my understanding of something is, the more I enjoy it, the more I can appreciate it. And it doesn't demystify it or devalue it. Matisse is no less valuable if I understand how something is put together than if I had no insight into that process at all.
And memory is no less valuable if you understand that it is a process of nerve cells closing and opening circuits.
Exactly. In fact, it's interesting. There is, for example, the Dalai Lama, who's interested in meditation and out-of-body experiences, has become interested in brain science and is, through his foundation, carrying out imaging experiments of what happens in the brain when people meditate. You know, I myself have no experience with it, but there's now fairly good evidence that certain medical disorders, for example, hypertension, are improved by meditation. Well, it would be invaluable to know what brain regions are recruited by meditative process. It doesn't in any way devalue that to know that the cingulate cortex is shut off. I'm making this up. That some particular region of the brain is activated while others are inhibited during meditation. It just makes the thing more wonderful.
Eric Kandel received the Nobel Prize in 2000. His memoir is called In Search of Memory.